the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Hello and welcome to the first Scholar's Corner podcast. I am your host, Andy Lemon.
Andy, didn't you say that in the intro that this was going to be the second one?
I'm confused now.
All right, we'll just call this one the second one.
All right,
George Washington, number two.
Welcome to George Washington. I'm your host, Andy Lemon.
And I'm Justin Hooper. All right, George Washington, what can we say about him? We all heard about him in kindergarten. We all know he's the first president of the United States.
Well, Justin, basically what we'll say today is the life of George Washington from his early years to his presidency. We will give great detail to his involvement with the French and Indian War, his contributions to farming, which I know you're dear in heart to, hillbilly, and his involvement in the Revolutionary War. Also, the decisions that he made, the way and how they impacted the United States.
The name of American, which belongs to you in your national capacity, must always exalt the just pride of patriotism, more than any appellation derived from local discriminations. All right.
Wow. So you're going to start the podcast off by stealing a great quote of Washington.
I do. I like that one.
That's
one of my favorite ones.
That is good.
Yeah.
I appreciate you for taking that off my hands because I didn't want to read it anyway. Well, our goal today is to keep the podcast under 60 minutes. However, we like to elaborate in great detail.
Oh, we do. We do. The key is to stay on topic. Like I said, we're going to try to focus George Washington, who he was. And we were discussing earlier when we first started this idea of why we picked George Washington. And I just want to let everybody know the reason we started with George Washington is because we wanted to start at the beginning as far as someone who has the most impact over, well, a nation as far with George Washington. I know we got us going. We were listening to a lot of historical facts or figures, which are big names, such as Napoleon, like I mentioned in the intro. So we thought we'd pick someone who had the greatest influence on our nation and go from there. So therefore, we're going to start here with George Washington. So, Andy, why don't you take it away here?
Well, and we're also starting at the top. You know, Washington, the first president of the United States.
Absolutely.
You know, we're not starting with Christopher Columbus or anything, but our background is political bickering. So
it is.
We might as well start with someone we can dig into.
Exactly.
Covering Washington will also present us with, you know, several difficult tasks, especially trying to stay under 60 minutes. One being Washington was involved with two major wars. They both take a great deal of the podcast to describe. You know, looking at our outlines we have prepared, the biggest portion of text is on those two wars, French and Indian War, and also the Revolutionary War. He also spent a large portion of his life, 16 years to be exact, dedicated to running his plantation. He contributed to several farming innovations. You know, to top it all off, Washington was also a two-term president. Not only that, but he was the first, and he set many precedents in being so.
He did. It is a good point to start at. He laid the groundwork as far as our nation goes, so he seemed only logical to start with him. So we're going to basically jump into the beginning, which is his early life. We're going to start with there and briefly try to cover everything. Like Andy said, we're not going into detail, super detail, along the French and Indian War and the American Revolution, but we are going to try to bring up the key facts in the wars and tie them in with George Washington.
All right, well, let's get this thing started. I'll start the timer. Let's shoot for 60 minutes. Well, I'll start with Washington's early life. George Washington, born February 22nd, 1732, at Pope's Creek in Westmoreland County, Virginia. Gus was George's father. He spent most of his time in other parts of Virginia overseeing the plantation, and George coincidentally wasn't very close to his father. And very soon here we have the first influential thing in George Washington's life. At age 11, Gus, his father, passes away.
Okay, and I want to stop you right there. As kids, we all hear about this George Washington cutting down the cherry tree. For those who are not familiar, there's a story where George Washington cuts down a cherry tree. Now, his father comes to him and says, "Did you cut down this cherry tree?" And we all know the quote. He says, "I cannot tell a lie." And he said, "Yes, he did." This, I hate to ruin it for you people, but it's actually false. This never happened. George Washington's biographer actually made this story up to kind of go along with George Washington's character. He was a very honest man. Thomas Jefferson actually makes a quote about how honest he was as far as his character goes. But his biographer used this story to try to relate it to the public. However, like I said, it is false. So our kindergarten story that we heard about George Washington cutting down a cherry tree is false.
I cannot tell a lie, but with my little hatchet, I did.
Yeah.
Mythbusters 101, and the podcast has begun. So after Gus passes away, George becomes closer to his brother. He was always close to his brother, Lawrence, and Lawrence really becomes his father. Well, George was inspired by Lawrence, who had served under the British Navy, spent most of his time at sea, and so George wanted to pursue a life at sea. Well, George's mother objected, and George, out of anger for his mother, moved in with his brother Lawrence. Well, later on down the line, Lawrence marries Anne Fairfax, George living with him. He reaps the benefits. She was from a wealthy family at Belvoir Estate. So this enables George to party with the rich and famous, so to speak. I mean, for his time, he was hanging out with the crowd that danced at balls and galas and, you know, hung out, learned about art. And he had a private library at his house. I remember him reading about how he studied from his own family's library. Well, George was very graceful on the dance floor and with the women as well. He's 6 foot tall. When he entered a room, everybody noticed, and it was hard to not notice a 6 foot four man of George's stature back in the 1700s. Well, he began meeting, this is at age 16, he began meeting a group of men and would discuss politics, the price of tobacco, and the economy. I'm sure they had a few discussions about King George II at the time as well. I personally believe this is where he began his Masonic ties. Obviously, he's 16, so he couldn't join the Masons, but I think in this group of men, there were Masons, and they influenced him to join the group. Inside this group is where George met Lord Fairfax. And Lord Fairfax offered George Washington a job as an assistant to a local surveyor that he employed. So George went out. He would spend most of his time in the backcountry working for this as the assistant to this local surveyor. I remember reading somewhere when George was not working, he would spend most of his time reflecting on nature and just his surroundings and really taking it all in. This also helps him later on the line when he goes to war with the French and Indian War to start off, and then, you know, fights the British, and most of these battles are fought in, you know, the country, and country that he had traveled mostly, Virginia, and it was his home. But land disputes abounded, and accurate surveys were desperately needed back then. And after the job was complete, after he got done working for the local surveyor, Washington returned to Belvoir Estate and celebrated his friend George William Fairfax's marriage to Sally Carey. George William Fairfax, obviously related to Anne Fairfax, Lawrence, his brother's wife. They would be really close friends with George later on in life, and at the time of the marriage, he was real close to friends. However, he married Sally Carey, and there is some historical debate here about the relationship between George Washington and Sally Carey. What exactly happened? And I'm not just talking George at 16 years old. I'm talking George from 16-year-old till death. This relationship continued on. Now, when George William Fairfax married Sally Carey, this is when the relationship began. But I don't want to, you know, give you any detail to what I think happened with the relationship. What I want to do is just give you some information. I'm actually going to read you a letter that George Washington wrote to Sally Carey. And if you Google information on her, you want to look up Sally Fairfax, because that would be her new name after she married George William Fairfax. Let me start with a quote. The letter that he wrote begins off, he was traveling in the backcountry. He had went up to Boston and visited some in North Carolina, and he was speaking of their women. "They fall far short of their Virginia counterparts, and I are, I dare say, a mere shadow of a certain ex-Fairfax County resident one might mention. Our intercourse is not unpleasant, but lacks the weight, the sparkle, the history of our own tete-a-tetes. Oh, Sally, I miss you terribly. One so needs in one's life a ravishing beauty. I thought it was a torture being near to you and not being able to touch, but now I know that being unable to see you, to hear at your own sweet voice, is a torture 1,000 times greater. Cordiality and friendship provide a needed sustenance, but its beauty, which thrills the palate, which overwhelms the senses. Be assured that I am, dear madam, with most unfeigned regard, your most obedient and humble servant, George Washington." And that was written sometime around George Washington's, he took over the Continental Army, I believe, and he was traveling up to Boston and places like that. Well, later on in life, after Sally's husband, George William Fairfax, passes away, she writes to her sister-in-law in 1778, confessing that she may have made a mistake in not marrying George Washington.
Now, Andy, based on that letter you just read, there's actually a book called The Glorious Struggle. Now, I haven't personally read it myself, but what it is it's a copy of his letters that he wrote during these key moments, during such as the Revolutionary War and the French and Indian War. And it was written by an author of Edward G. Lingle. This would be one I would recommend checking out for anybody who's curious as far as the events that went on in George Washington's life.
And what amazes me is, as we sit here at the computer screen, there are 41 new books on Amazon.com for $5.75. And, you know, don't take that as a plug for Amazon.com. I'm not getting paid by them, though I would not turn down a check. I find it amazing that a book of that detail can be only $5.75. That's outstanding. But back to the course here. Washington, in 1749... would acquire his survey license and become surveyor of Culpeper County, which would mean he's getting paid in cash and land to go out in the backcountry and survey people's property for him.
And I just want to jump in there, Andy, and this is kind of getting ahead of course, but with the surveying license that he got, he actually surveyed the land that the nation's capital is on. It was land called Foggy Bottom. It was kind of up there in Virginia. And he actually surveyed Washington, D.C., as we know.
I believe it was 10 square miles. Is that correct? 10 square miles. And when they were finished surveying it, they left big blocks at the corners of the city. And they stayed there for years. They might still be there. Looks like we have some research to do on that.
We do. And another fact, going back to the Capitol, which is what you a topic that you brought up to me the last couple days, is actually not square. It's shaped like a circle.
A diamond. I didn't know that. That's good, though, to point out. Well, back on track again. Lawrence, Washington's brother, and this would be, I would call this, outside of Sally Fairfax, the second most influential thing in the early life of George. But Lawrence, his brother and father figure, comes down with tuberculosis. And in 1751, Lawrence asked George Washington to accompany him to Barbados, hoping to remedy his illness, get down there to the nice Caribbean air and clear out the lungs, is I'm guessing what he was thinking. There wasn't much medical attention for tuberculosis back in those days. This would become the only time Washington leaves the United States in his entire life. However, on his trip, Washington would contract smallpox. He does survive from the stint with smallpox, and this would become his first run in with death, which this would become a common theme for us, and we will find out later in the podcast how often he did run into death.
He was always dying, it looked like. It seemed to me.
It did. And
I mean, he was surviving everything.
You're not alone. People of his day thought he was dead several times.
Oh, my goodness.
It was terrible.
It was very...
Well, 6 months later, Lawrence, his brother, passes away. From what I understand, this is actually where Washington would inherit his estate at Mount Vernon, which we will get into in a couple of pages. Washington returns home from Barbados, 1752, 19 years old. George goes up to Lieutenant Governor Robert Dinwiddie and asks for Lawrence's Adjutant General's position. I can't imagine a 19-year-old walking up to the governor of a state and saying, "Excuse me, sir, my brother previously held this general's position, you know, with your army. I would like to be appointed to that position because I have no military experience and I'm related to him." I mean, I don't know what would come out.
Just to put that in perspective, this is a kid that would, in today's standard, be fresh out of high school, walking up to Obama right out of high school and just saying, "I'd like to lead the Afghan war," and him sending him over there.
Right.
This is the equivalent to that.
Pretty close. I think the adjutant is actually like a staff officer.
Yeah, you are correct.
But still, that's a pretty large position for a 19-year-old.
19 years old.
And he just walks up to the governor. Now, this would lead me to believe that this did have something to do with his Masonic tie. It's about the same time he did receive his Master Mason certification. Not that it's certification, but third degree of the Freemasons.
Right, right, yeah.
Master Mason in his lodge. I was age 19.
So he had a good networking then. By this time,
he was networked. And I did forget to point out, jumping back a little bit, when he got his survey license and was appointed surveyor of Culpeper County, Lord Fairfax played a huge role in that. He was instrumental in him getting that job. But at this time, a ludicrous request for a young man with no military experience to ask the governor of Virginia for a top military post. But the governor appoints George, one of four military districts, although the smallest. I think he liked him and appreciated what he saw in George's ambition. So now we will, George's adjutant general to the Virginia militia, and we begin the French and Indian War. Basically, to start this off, Governor Dinwiddie learns of a broadening French presence in the upper Ohio Valley. The French want to expand their control over the rivers to transport the furs to Europe. And Governor Dinwiddie writes to King George II for instructions. King George II advises Governor Dinwiddie, "The French must be told to leave." And Washington volunteers for this impossible task. So what we have is Washington going to put together a group of six men, and they're going to begin a six-week journey up to Fort Le Beau near Lake Erie, where George will deliver the ultimatum that French people, you must leave our area. You know, once again, another ludicrous thing to expect of a 19-year-old to do.
Telling them, cut French and get out of our country.
Yeah, you must be told to leave. And that's basically what he did. He goes up there and tells them that, and obviously the the French decline to leave gracefully and laugh a little bit about this kid asking them to leave his their area. And on the journey back, Washington is shot at by an Indian, falls into the icy Allegheny River, and slept in buckskins that froze to his body. By my count, that is four, where he, you know, four chances at death. Four run-ins with death.
Yeah, he was looking death in the eye.
Yes.
At this point.
A man falls into the icy Allegheny River.
After being shot.
At.
Shot at.
By an Indian.
By an Indian.
Indians are not bad shots. Upon Washington's return, Governor Dinwiddie requests Washington to write a report of his journey. Well, Washington's account would appear in London as well as in the colonies. And the governor promotes Washington to lieutenant colonel and asks George Washington to recruit 100 men. At age 21, Washington is promoted to lieutenant colonel. In 1754, Washington was ordered to defend a new fort constructed on the Ohio, which would be present-day Pittsburgh. In 1754, the 21-year-old Washington, ordered to defend the fort, leaves and heads towards the area of present-day Pittsburgh. And en route, Washington learns the French have already seized the fort and actually constructed their own larger fort, Fort Duquesne. This will be a very, very big fort in our next few minutes of podcasting. May 8th, 1754, still en route to Fort Duquesne. It was a little outside, I want to say about 15 miles away from Fort Duquesne. Scouts from Washington's party learn of a French scouting party of about 50 men, and under the cover of darkness, Washington's troops and 15 Iroquois attack a French scouting party. Stunned, the French barely retaliated. The French commander, Ensign Joseph Colon de Jumonville, was killed by the Iroquois chief, and this would be known as the Battle of Jumonville. The Iroquois chief is actually would be known as the Half King, and from what I understand, the French suffered 12 killed, 2 wounded, and 21 captured. After the fighting had commenced, Jumonville was handing, who reached into his pocket to hand Washington a set of papers to show that he was just a scouting party. And from behind the Half King, the Seneca chief came up with a hatchet and drove it into the back of Jumonville's scalp. That's brutal. Now, from what I understand, also, Washington did not approve of this, but you have to understand, this is the French and Indian War, so Washington is making allies with the French. You know, the Indians, very barbaric at this time, and, you know, not wanting to step on their feet, Washington stays mum. So this would be the Battle of Jumonville Glen. The American group, the American soldiers, are, I call them American, I guess at this time they were colonial soldiers, they would have zero killed or wounded. After this, after Jumonville is passed away with a hatchet in his head, Washington fears retaliation. He orders a stockade to be built approximately 15 miles east in an open clearing known as the Great Meadows. And actually in 1771, Washington would purchase this land. Just a little tidbit of info there. The Great Meadows was strategically a bad location because it was low-lying and in the open. And in my opinion, this shows Washington's lack of military experience. Of course, he's 21 years old. You know, give the guy a little slack here. He's leading an army, and he just won a pretty decent battle at the Battle of Jumonville Glen, attacking 50 Frenchmen. But the Half-King, the Seneca chief, would say, George Washington's ally, Seneca chief, Half-King, complained that Washington was a good-natured man but had no experience. When referring to the fort, The half-king said Washington made no fortifications at all, but that little thing upon the meadow. And he's referring to Fort Necessity, of course. Fort Necessity, like I said, was a bad location. And on July 2nd, 1754, the French, led by Jumonville's brother, attacks Fort Necessity, which would become known as the Battle of the Great Meadow. Some call it the Battle of Fort Necessity, but I think the Battle of the Great Meadow
sounds much better. Thank now, going you. Back to that fort, today, is there anything there? Is there any memorial or anything like that?
Actually, yes. Fort Necessity National Battlefield in Pennsylvania, and a reproduction of the fort has been built. The park would also feature General Braddock's grave and Mount Washington Tavern. But the reproduction of the fort, if you look at this thing, I mean, it's a circle. It's a circle, and it's like fence pickets, but made out of pieces of wood, like pieces of trees almost. And they can't be taller than 8 foot. I'd venture to say that most of them are 6 foot tall fence pickets, maybe 7 foot tall fence pickets, and they're spaced apart and they're staggered in this octagonal circular form. It's real rimshot. It is by far the worst fort I've ever seen constructed. And in the middle of it is the a little like pole barn type deal, which is the stockade Washington wanted to have built to store munitions and other supplies.
So they never actually had a wall around it. Did you say the limbs were staggered?
They were it was like a fence, but it was poorly constructed.
Oh, I see.
During the Battle of the Great Meadow, Washington was greatly outnumbered. It started raining. This caused problems for Washington. His men hunkered behind his rimshod fence structure. And French sharpshooters just sat outside the meadow and picked off the Virginians with ease. So the French, they came out with a white flag drawn on a musket, and the French suggested surrender to Washington. So Washington sends out his interpreter, because he doesn't speak French, obviously. Captain Van Bram would be the interpreter. And Washington ends up signing a surrender and unwittingly admitted to the assassinated of Ensign Joseph Colon de Jumonville at the suspicion that Captain Van Bram misinterpreted intentionally the treaty. This would become a fairly big deal because the French would use this as proof that the war was initiated by the British. At the Battle of the Great Meadow, Washington suffers 21 killed, 70 wounded, and 369 captured. This would mark the start of the French and Indian War, which actually, I guess you could say, the Battle of Jumonville Glen would be the start of the French and Indian War, but not marked as the start the Battle of the Great Meadows is. So, just for your history test, when your teacher is out there asking you those questions. Now, upon Washington's return to Virginia, the House of Burgesses mentions and thanks, and I believe this is in September when they convened again, they thank all the soldiers from this battle, except for two, and one is Captain Van Bram, for he is suspected of treason for intentionally misinterpreting the treaty that Washington signed, or the surrender that Washington had signed. Upon Washington's return, he assumed his military career was over, and Washington commenced to reside at Mount Vernon, and he resigned his commission. King George and Parliament decided that British regulars would be more reliable anyway than the colonial militia. In 1755, the British sent an army to win the war against the French. General Edward Braddock took charge in Virginia. Now, Washington, still longing to have a military career, went to Braddock and negotiated a position in rank equal to British officers. Braddock said, okay, you know, you're a good guy, I like your experience, you know the land and I need you, really. So Washington would serve as a volunteer and aide to Braddock. The army would be put together and advance toward Fort Duquesne. Along the way, Washington would fight dysentery and was actually dangerously ill. That's five, isn't it?
That is five.
Five encounters with death for Washington. As the British Army and Washington approached Fort Duquesne, I believe they were probably just a few miles, 11 miles from Fort Duquesne, we would have the Battle of the Monongahela. 900 French troops, mainly Indians, attacked the British. As the British crossed the Monongahela River, the Indians and the French began their attack. The British had a much larger force, but they were unable to overcome the shock of the screaming attackers who snatched scalps with lightning speed. 1,300 British and American troops against 600 French and Indian troops. Washington had two horses shot from under him, was shot through his hat, and four musket balls passed through his coat. But he escaped without serious injury. And if you don't count the four musket balls and the hat shot individually, this would be encounter with death number six. General Braddock was shot through the lung. This would be a wound that would end him. He did not escape without serious injury. He was killed in this battle. And I did forget to mention Fort Necessity, the National Battlefield, National Park Service. I did say that General Braddock's grave was there. I forgot to mention that he would be coming up later. But this Battle of the Monongahela is geographically close to Fort Necessity National Battlefield, where General Braddock's grave has been placed. Washington was the only officer to survive the battle without being wounded. And this is some information that we receive. However, I do have a little bit of conflicting information. I believe they might be talking about Washington was the only high-ranking officer to survive the battle without being wounded. Because from what I understand, out of the 86 officers, 26 were killed and 37 were wounded. So, you know, my math being pretty bad, it would be 63 out of commission. That would leave us a total of an additional 23 officers left. So I don't know what the context of that quote is, but Washington is regarded as the only officer to survive the Battle of the Monongahela without being wounded. British and Americans suffered 456 killed and 422 wounded. Officers were targeted by the Indians, as you can tell. It was said that out of 50 women the British brought along as maids, only 5 returned. 2 were killed and the others taken captive, which I can imagine back in the day, you know, the Indians would have some pretty brutal uses for the women that they took captive. And Washington would lead the retreat. They would retreat, the British and everybody would retreat back across the Monongahela River. And upon his return to Washington, upon his return to Virginia, Washington was a hero. And word had circulated that he had actually passed away, which at this time would be no surprise to anyone. So he wrote to his family immediately because he did not want to alert them. He wanted to let them know the contrary. He was still alive and well. But Washington did use his new fame, his military hero status, to negotiate a new assignment from Governor Dinwiddie. Once again, Governor Dinwiddie back in the picture. And Colonel and Commander-in-Chief of the Virginia Regiment at age 22. Governor Dinwiddie agrees, and he promotes young George Washington to lead his Virginia Regiment. As Commander-in-Chief of the Virginia Regiment, George got to select his own officers. He was paid very well, and he fashioned his own uniform, which you'll see in a lot of paintings, the blue coat. He was also responsible for the budget. Actually, I believe the Virginia Regiment became known as the Blue Coats. He also recommended sites for fortification and improvements to existing ones. He trained the militia to be vigilant against Native American attacks and corrected their discipline issues, which I'm sure was largely influenced by the Battle of the Monongahela.
Good. That was good.
Thank you. You like that? I stressed that fact, didn't I? George and Martha Dandridge Curtis became engaged, wealthiest widow in Virginia, might I add, and they were wed on January 6, 1759. And shortly thereafter, he would resign his military post and retire to Mount Vernon.
Prior to that, Andy, in 1758, Washington was part of the Forbes expedition, prompted French evacuation of Fort Duquesne and the British establishment of Pittsburgh.
Nice. Yes, I did forget about that. And as the Forbes expedition didn't actually beat the French and Indians at Fort Duquesne, what had happened is the British and the Americans went up there, and there was a battle, and they had to retreat a little bit. And the French, they didn't like Fort Duquesne anyway, and shortly before the Forbes expedition engaged them, they were planning on evacuating anyhow. So what they did is they evacuated in the night and burnt Fort Duquesne. So back in Mount Vernon, Washington's residing. The farming portion of his life, 16 years as a Virginia planter and politician. He begins his political career, and he is elected to the seat on the Virginia House of Burgesses. That was, the start of his political career, and he would spend a ton of time at Mount Vernon. While living there, George experimented with new farming techniques. He used crop rotation. He switched from soil-destructive tobacco to wheat. He invented and sold the design of the round barn, which I've seen most people regard this as the 16-sided treading barn. It's amazing design. His horses will tread around in a circle, and they'll have straw on the ground. And as the horses tread, they break the straw down into other particles, and I'm not much of a farmer, but it drops down below the floor that the horses are treading or jogging in a circle on, and it comes into a grain, and the people collect it, and they move it onto the grist mill, which Washington built the most advanced grist mill of his time. It was fed by a mill race, which he constructed for over 2 miles, connecting to a pond that was fed by streams. And the mill race powers the grist mill by a 16-foot water wheel. They say this, like I said at the time, the grist mill is one of the most advanced creations.
This circle that you're speaking of, you know what happens if you had the square barn and tried to do this in a square barn, right?
The horse would pee in the corner.
Exactly. They don't.
And it would destroy the straw.
Exactly.
Yes. So that is, Washington invented the round barn for this reason.
If you step back, that's kind of
amazing. Yeah, people are going, what the hell, what's a round barn? Well, you would be losing a lot of straw in a square barn, and that's something that the people in the 1700s encountered.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The distillery. Now, this was built in 1797 at the urge of a farmer manager, James Anderson. So I don't want to jump too far ahead, but while we're covering farming, this was a large part of Washington's life at Mount Vernon. James Anderson had experience making Scottish whiskey, and he talked Washington into building the distillery. By 1799, this distillery was producing 11,000 gallons of whiskey, the most in the United States. And the structure shows Washington's commitment to improvising on his farming and taking risk to advance production. And I do want to hit another myth. We're coming to Washington smoking weed. Washington did not smoke weed. What Washington did is he grew hemp on his farm. He used most of the hemp to make rope, and he also used it for medicinal purposes as a syrup. He did not use hemp for recreational use. With that said, Justin, I think we just lost half of our viewers. Oh, gosh. Hemp is a durable fiber, and it's cultivated from plants of the cannabis genus. Cultivated only for industrial use, non-drug use. It contains less than 1% of THC, whereas marijuana can contain between 6 to 20% THC. So, obviously, not a pothead.
Exactly. Couldn't have been.
You'll get a dollar bill, and it'll have a joint hanging out of Washington's mouth. I mean, I've encountered that. I've seen the shirts, the T-shirts, and online, you run into figures on social networking sites.
I've never seen a T-shirt.
Never
seen a T-shirt.
Well, I think we can hook you up with one of those.
Google that later on.
We'll definitely Google that later on. George Washington's Mount Vernon Estate and Gardens, 10 miles south of D.C., a beautiful place, a must-visit if you go to D.C. Mount Vernon is surprisingly open 7 days a week, including holidays and Christmas.
All right, Andy, I believe that brings us to the Revolutionary War, or the War of Independence, as it was called. Now, a few things that kind of led to this war was the battle cry by the colonies, taxation without representation. They believed that the taxes they were paying, implemented by a king and parliament an ocean away, they were across the Atlantic, wasn't fair. A lot of things going on at this time. The Stamp Act, which was Parliament passed the stamp tax as a way to raise revenue for offsetting the expense of sending British troops to guard America's frontiers borders. Although its cost was trivial, colonists believed it was a concept was monumental. Protests began in the words, "No taxation without representation," is basically where we got the start of this. Now, a few things that kind of also led, colonists were angry. And a lot of people heard about the Boston Massacre. It actually wasn't a massacre. I believe, if memory serves me right, I think 4 soldiers died. Maybe 3. Basically, to get the point across, it wasn't a massacre. Let me get the exact count on that. It was actually...
I believe you mean colonists.
I do mean colonists.
Okay.
Thank you. I said soldiers, didn't I?
Welcome for the correction.
Yeah, thank you very much. What it was is the Britain soldiers killed 4 colonists. And here's actually a fun fact. Our second president actually defended the soldiers in court and got them acquitted. And the colonists were kind of outraged about this at the time. But he was appointed, so he did his best to defend him, and he actually got him acquitted.
Attorney John Adams.
Yes, Attorney
John.
Has
a nice ring to it.
Yeah, and second president of the United States.
And second cousin to Samuel Adams, a malter, not a brewer.
And another famous lead to this war was the Boston Tea Party. Now, a lot of people know about the Boston Tea Party. It happened in 1773, December 16th. And what happened, it was the members of the Sons of Liberty, which was, you know, a group, its members organized protests against British policy that, while peaceful at first, sometimes, you know, degenerated into more violent demonstrations, such as the Tea Party. Now, just to throw this out there, in the Sons of Liberty, Sam Adams was a member of the Sons of Liberty, along with a famous writer that we all heard about that said the British were coming, Paul Revere, Son of Liberty. And what happened, it was they organized this Boston Tea Party, and which was, just to sum it up real fast, they dressed as Indians, and they went aboard the British ships, and they threw all the tea overboard, which this outraged Britain.
Did you say dressed as Indians?
They dressed as Indians.
Isn't that amazing?
They did, yeah.
What a great idea.
Yeah. It wasn't the colonists, it was Indians.
Now you know what the colonists... think about Indians and how they portray them. They're running onto ships and rummaging their tea supplies and tossing it into the harbor.
Which, it didn't fool anybody, but it was just the principle of the matter. But actually, the tea got paid for by Benjamin Franklin. He actually went to Britain and apologize and paid for the team. I mean, he wasn't a member of the Sons of Liberty. He, I think, was just trying to, you know, cover up what they did. But this obviously leads into the American Revolution. Now, starting at the American Revolution, we'll go to the Second Continental Congress meeting in Philadelphia. They appoint Washington commander-in-chief of the Continental Army.
Before we get too far, I want to say Washington went to the first Continental Congress in Philadelphia in 1774 as part of the Virginia delegation. Very instrumental because he meets John and Sam Adams. John Adams, as we know, would become his vice president later in this podcast. They all agreed at the First Continental Congress to boycott British goods, as well as to meet again in May 1775, which would be the Second Continental Congress. Before the Second Continental Congress can happen, we have the Battle of Lexington and Concord.
A very important battle in the American Revolution.
Yes.
Okay, basically the Battle of Lexington and Concord. It was just the first military engagement of the American Revolutionary War. Obviously a failure. Something that was kind of different was I don't think we were prepared for what was going to happen, because people actually showed up to watch this battle. They would gather on the hillside, and I guess what happened was, you know, during the end of this battle, we had people running and fleeing and running away from this battle. But basically, Battle of Lexington and Concord, first engagement in the Revolutionary War, and that's about all.
We did have good intel, though. I mean, basically, the British Army regulars, they learned of secret orders to capture and destroy military supplies, but the Patriots learned about it beforehand and moved them weeks before. So that leads us up to the Second Continental Congress, as you were...
Yeah, the Second Continental Congress, and this is where George Washington comes in. It appoints him as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, and he accepts this, a quote by George Washington by accepting this was, "I beg it may be remembered by every gentleman in the room that I this day declare with the utmost sincerity, I do not think myself equal to the command I am honored with." Love that quote. He asked for reimbursements of expenses, but here's a big thing. No pay. So he's going to do this without pay.
Free.
Mm-hmm.
We would learn as his, he becomes president of the United States in the future that he also requests no pay. But Congress objects because it would set a precedent for only rich people to become elected president and run for president. But that didn't happen. Back on track. Prior to his appointment as general, he was appointed at the Second Continental Congress to head committees on military matters, and he always wore his military uniform as a...